Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Okay, so it's Mental Health Monday. My next guest is going to be speaking about his own mental health, and we're going to take a look at the wider issue of mental health within sport, I'm very pleased to say. Chris Kirkland joins us in the studio. Chris, great to see you. Thank you for your time.
No problem at all.
Chris, fair to say you had a good footballing career. Liverpool Football Club, people will always associate you with as well. You played at a host of other clubs as well, right across the country.
Yeah, no, I've been lucky when I look back and see the teams I've played for. You know, at the start of my career, I've always supported Liverpool. I used to come up with my dad, I used to catch the bus from Hinckley, as people know. So to play for Liverpool and Sheffield Wednesday and Wigan, you know, I took them three at the start of my career, and as I say, the others have been a bonus as well. But it's certainly gone quick when you look back at just how quick it is. You know, I can remember my debut against Tranmere in the old Worthington Cup many years ago, and all of a sudden it's your career's finished.
I guess growing up, you were often thinking about your physical health. Twinges, injuries, which people will know you had your fair share of as well, that what your body physically was doing was something you were always at the very much at the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, I mean, but when we first started out, when I was at Coventry, you know, core weights, that wasn't in. There was nothing like that. So that's only coming in the last 5-10 years possibly. But yeah, back then it was, you did nothing like that. You just trained. You trained, you played, you know, you got injured. As soon as you felt right, you trained again. It's totally different now. There's a lot more scientific work goes into it these days. But yeah, I had my struggles. When I was at Liverpool, I had a back problem there. Ended up having a back operation. Did my cruciate, you know, broke my fingers, broke my wrist. This was all at Liverpool. So it was a tough time, but I wouldn't swap it for the world. You know, just to play one game for Liverpool, it was great. And then when I left Liverpool, I pretty much stayed fit for the rest of my career.
With that in mind as well, was the focus or were the injuries that you got physically, did that ever have an impact on the way you were thinking about what you were capable of in terms of performing on a weekly basis?
I mean, I had a lot of injections to play through a lot of games, particularly when I was at Wigan. But again, I hardly missed any games when I was there. You know, people say, oh, he was always injured. It wasn't actually from 2006, 2007, right until I finished. I was, you know, I had a great injury record, probably the best at any club I'd been at. But yeah, they do. I mean, the injuries at Liverpool knocked the stuffing out of me. And the hardest thing now is looking back and thinking what I could have achieved if I wouldn't have got the injuries. Because obviously moving to Liverpool, it was a big fee. You know, a lot was expected of me, which back then as a kid, you're not bothered. You don't even think about that. You know, I didn't even think about the pressure, nothing like that. I just wanted to play. I wanted to train. It's not until you get older, I've said this many times, that you realise when you look back and you think, ooh, that was a big game I played in there. You know, the magnitude of some games. But it definitely knocked the stuffing out of it at Liverpool. And that's the biggest regret I've got, is just how far or how good I could have been. Because there's no doubt once you get a serious injury, you're never the same again. And I got a few in a quick succession at Liverpool, which, as I said, knocked the stuffing out of me.
Can we move on to your mental health? Yeah. I know that depression and anxiety has been an issue which you've been keen to talk about and that you've raised in terms of your own experience. We're obviously talking to you as a former professional athlete, professional footballer as well. Do you believe that your mental health issues that you faced are in any way linked to the career that you've had, or do you put yourself simply in that category of it affects one in four people and I'm one in four people?
Possibly. I can't say during my career. I mean, it was when I left Wigan. I never wanted to leave Wigan. Loved it there. I had a great, you know, I got my career back on track after I left Liverpool. And I never wanted to leave there. And I left and went to Sheffield Wednesday, which is, like Liverpool, marvellous club, fantastic tradition. And every day I was there, I didn't want to be there. It was tough, the travelling, you know, we talk about traffic all the time, getting stuck. I was getting anxious if I wouldn't get home and see my daughter. I was thinking, well, if I don't get home till this time, then I've got to set off. It was my mind was just going overtime. And the biggest relief was actually when I played. I played every game that season in the 2012 season and got player of the season. And then the season after, I played 40 out of the 46 games. So, as I said, my injury record were fine, but it was eating away at me. And if it wasn't for Andy Rhodes, the goalie coach there, who gave me... They knew something was wrong. They didn't know the full extent of it. Because after I signed for him at the end of... in the middle of May, which obviously it can't be made official until July the 1st. So as soon as I signed, you know, that May, June, I was thinking, what have I done? You know, I don't want to go back for pre-season here. I don't want to do it. So they knew something was wrong. Andy was great. He gave me a routine. He said, right, these are the days you're going to be in. Nothing else. So get your head around this. These are the days you're going to be in. You don't have to travel for warm downs or anything like that. Stay at home. So they gave me a routine that I knew would not change, which for peace of mind was brilliant with me. So as I said, I owe a lot to Andy Rhodes, what he did for me there, and the fans as well. I mean, as I said, you don't walk away easily from a club like that, same as Liverpool. It's a magnificent club. And as I said, I had a good 3 years there.
Did you sort of in the first instance sort of write it off as the stresses of essentially a new job or the same job but in a different part of the country, the stresses of, you know, getting out and about on the road and the traffic and the issues and everything that you're dealing with?
Not really, no. I mean, I've always been an anxious person, but I remember when I first got into the England squad under 18s, I didn't want to go away. You know, I didn't want to be away from home. So I've always been, you know, worried about that side of it. It's just it was building up, you know, from 2012 up until, you know, a couple of months ago when I come out and said what had been the problems, and it was just, I just didn't see a way out of it. It was just, and then you've got your problems, you know, you in your own life as well. Everyone has their, you know, family issues and whatnot, and all that added on together was the third year when I was there. Kieran Westwood come in at Sheffield Wednesday, and I was actually glad that I was not going to be playing, which is wrong. But by that time, after two more years, my head was just, it was mangled, and the last thing I was thinking about was playing at the weekend. So it was big relief actually that I could just be a number two and concentrate on helping the number one instead of me worrying about the games coming up.
Do you think as well that, you know, people that listen to this will always think a professional footballer get paid loads of money, what have they got to worry about as well? With that in mind as well, I guess you were also thinking, well, I'm the main income earner maybe for that household. You know, this, I'm a grown man out there trying to earn a living for my family as well. Did you feel a sense of responsibility
Absolutely.
To carry on, even though you might have had options elsewhere?
Absolutely, yeah. When I left for Sheffield Wednesday, it was, to be honest, it was the only option I had, because I didn't play the last 2 years at Wigan under Roberto. So for 2 years I'd not played. So wherever I went, I had to get back to an English manager and an English goalie coach, because it's, I've said before, when I've worked with a foreign goalie coach, my game just goes completely. It's totally different training. So I knew under Roberto that my game was gone. I needed to go somewhere that had an English goalie coach and an English manager, and Sheffield Wednesday were the perfect fit. Looking back now, as I said, it was tough going there, but I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad I stuck it out as long as I could. I was going to sign for him again in 2015. They wanted me to sign again. And I was in my gym kit, I was there, I was first day pre-season 2015, I was just about to go upstairs to sign. I say, I had all my kit on, getting ready to train, and somebody just says, no, you can't do this now. You know, you've had 3 years, there's no way you can sign. And I just went up and said, look, I've got some problems, I can't sign. And, you know, everyone was devastated, which made it even harder to walk away. Because you make some good friends at clubs, and say Andy was devastated, and I was crying my eyes out, but I just had to get in the car and drive away. And they understood that, well, I think they'll understand now, because obviously what's come out, why I had to make that decision.
I mean, in terms of that, those moments, how was that depression, and you talked about the anxiety as well, how was that manifesting itself on a day-to-day basis?
It just drags you down. You can feel it happening. You can feel yourself slipping away. I've said before, it's like somebody, you're conscious of what's going on, but it's like somebody enters your body and pins you down and ties you down, and you just can't get out. And you can see them, you know, ruining your life, basically, but you can't do anything about it. And you're trapped. And it's like, as I said, I've said many times that I couldn't wait to get to sleep at night, which was difficult getting to sleep. But for that time you're asleep, you know, you're at peace sort of thing. But then I didn't want to wake up in the mornings, because it all started again. But I knew I needed to get help. I signed for Preston 2015-2016, which was local. I was number two to Jordan Pickford there. So again, I knew my role. I was only local. And then I left there and signed for Bury. And this is where it really hit home. And we was in Portugal, and I just had a meltdown when I was out there in pre-season. I just rang Leona. I said, look, I've got to get home. And Leona had a doctor's appointment. It was nothing serious. I didn't need to be there for it. But we used that as an excuse to get me back. And then it all just went from there. The Dave Flitcroft was great. The club were brilliant at Bury. They gave me a couple of weeks off. I went back training because I wanted to give it another go just in case I had regrets. And after about a third day of training, I wasn't even diving. I just walked off the pitch and said, no, I've got to stop now. And that's when I contacted the PFA. And I met Simon Barker at the PFA, and things started to get put into place after that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that the names of the people that you spoke to, that those people you made contact with, if you like, or shared a little bit, you seem to have had a largely positive response.
It's been brilliant.
From them.
Yeah, it's been great. As I said, I knew I was worried where I was going. Obviously, I've got a great wife and a lovely daughter, and I was just worried where, you know, you see things. As I said, Gary Speed was on my mind, just how bad he was before he did what he did. I mean, nobody knows the circumstances. It was tragic, you know, what happened to Gary, and he was a cracking man, a wonderful man. But I was just, I just didn't want it to go any far. I don't know what, looked in the mirror one day, I thought, right, it's got to stop now. And I contacted PFA, Simon Barker, met him at Worsley Marriott in Manchester. He put me in contact with Mickey Bennett, who's a player welfare for the PFA. And then it went from there, met Mickey a few times, and then he put me in contact with a lady in Manchester, and I've been seeing her ever since, and she's been a godsend to me. She's helped me get back on the straight and narrow.
You mentioned Gary Speed there. When the news of his death broke, I think people were absolutely just shocked by it. But people also couldn't get a sense of why it could possibly have happened. When you heard the news, did you think about it differently because of your own experience? Did you think, I can see how somebody might find themselves in that situation?
When Gary, I mean, I wasn't going through it then. But looking back now and knowing the way I felt then, you know, it's horrible as it, you know, I could not see why he's done it or anything like that, but I can see why people get into a desperation place, yeah, definitely. But he was a wonderful man, Gary, and he's probably one of the least, you know, players that you'd ever say would do that. He was so well liked, so respected in the game, top player, but it just goes to show, you know, this disease, it holds no prisoners.
In terms of those lowest of the lowest moments that you felt, how soon or how close were those moments to maybe a match day? I often think about, you know, how fans see footballers on the pitch and how they watch them and criticise, you know, a goalkeeper who should have come for a cross or flapped at it when he should have punched it and so on and so forth. But I wonder whether or not you might have had moments in and around football matches which football fans would have had absolutely no idea about at all.
Yeah. I mean, the first season was great. I played 46 games. Probably the best season I've ever had. I got player of the season. Second season, I was there was some guy, Bolton, at home for Sheffield Wednesday. Reminds me of one I had. Bad game, and I wanted to come off after 15 minutes. I just couldn't concentrate, couldn't do anything. Felt like everyone was looking at me. You know, I just wanted the ground to open up and swallow me up. But there was definitely games where it was on my mind constantly. And yeah, when you've got to try and play well as well, I used to go home and I was shattered after games, because not just the mental side of playing, but what else was going on as well. I was physically and mentally knackered.
When you say it was on your mind, what were you thinking? Like, can you put into words what you were thinking on a pitch when you're trying to read a game?
I was just thinking, what if I make a mistake? You know, this could, you know, my family's there watching. What if I make a mistake? What if I lose my place? You know, I'm travelling all this way. I don't want to be on the bench. But then the third year, as I said, it was a big relief when I was on the bench because of what I went through that second year, knowing what I was going through in certain games. I just thought, well, at least I don't have to worry about that now. I can try and concentrate on... I didn't concentrate and get myself better because it was still a couple of years after that, but it was a big relief. I wouldn't have the pressure of playing it weekends.
What were the family, what were they aware of in terms of what you were going through?
Leona, my wife, we've been together since 18, 19 years now. She knew that she didn't know the full extent because I hid all of it more or less from her because, as you said before, I'm the man of the house. You know, you've got to support your family. So I hid a lot of stuff from her. And then... She knew the full extent when, and people say, well, how can she not know? Because when you can hide things, anyone knows you can hide stuff. You know, you put on a face and you don't want your daughter to see you sad or anything like that. But 2000, after I signed for Bury, she knew there was a problem and she knew that I had to get help. When I come home from Portugal, she says, right, you know, this is worse than what you've been letting on in it. And I told her everything and she said, right, let's sort it out. Let's get help. And she's been there every step of the way.
Those moments, those sort of breakdown moments you talked about, was that an emotional reaction? Did that feel like, was it about tears? Was it about sort of just needing a break away from the game
Everything.
To forget about who you were and the situation you found yourself in?
That's why I left Bury, because I needed just to get away. I was putting a statement. I just needed to forget about football and concentrate on myself and the family. And that's why I made that decision. Football was the last thing on my mind. I just didn't want to go in and train, which I've never been like that. So I knew that I had to sort myself out, and we managed to do that eventually through the PFA. And as I said, I'm still seeing the lady now, and I'm sure I will be for a while to come. But I'm in a you know, a great place now, a much better place. Still have my days, as anyone does, you know. But I want my days to be normal, like other people's days are, when they don't feel great, you know, work or whatever. And I'm finally getting to that now.
Chris, it's great to hear this story. Not that it's, you know, a great experience that you've had as well, but again, it opens people's eyes up to the idea that there are other things going on in people's lives. One in four people will be affected by mental illness or negative mental health in their lifetime as well. You look at a football team, that's two or three members of every single football team in every single league right across the country. So it's out there, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it wasn't just to do it for sports people. It's to do it for everyone, you know. Joe Blogs on the Street, everyone, this is, because everyone suffers with it. I was at a stage where I was ready to talk about it. I wanted to help other people because simply what I've been through. And talking has helped me hugely. Even, you know, this today, it helps me to keep perspective. You know, no, I don't want to go back to that. Know what I have to do. I've got triggers, you know, that I've put into place. You know, like if I'm, you know, when I'm on my own, that's not good. So I'll go out for a walk, I'll go out for a run, I'll go to the gym, stuff like that. So I know what I've got to do now. And so my wife's great as well. So we're conscious not to leave myself on my own, because that's when you can start having thoughts, sort of thing. And that's when you can get down. So I know all the stuff that I've got to do, and we've been doing it, and that's just the way it's going to be now. And as I say, I'm going to face it head on, and, you know, there'll only be one winner.
I wonder whether or not that's a good example. You mentioned there, you know, it's not just about footballers or people within sports, it's people in everyday life. Those thoughts that you might have now, presumably now, they're not about whether or not you're going to be in the first team, whether or not you're going to be travelling away in the FA Cup third round or something like that. They're about Chris Kirkland, who's got his own, you know, goalkeeping academy, or who's involved in the media as well. So do the thoughts change in terms of your concerns
there? Yeah, there's not as much pressure. I mean, I set up the academy because I needed a focus. I really enjoy it. It's brilliant. The lads are great. You know, we have a laugh and stuff like that, so that's great. And then I do a lot of work for Liverpool TV, which is, again, is brilliant. I'm a Liverpool fan. I always have been. I've played for the club. So to be able to work for them is a privilege as well. It's just about keeping busy, make sure I'm not, you know, make sure I occupy my time. I like a game of golf. I love walking a dog. You know, I'll go regular 10 miles out with him a day, and just to get out. And you feel a lot better when you do it. And that's my advice to people. You know, don't just sit in the house and let things fester. You know, get out, go for a walk, go and get some fresh air, just to hear noise as well, just to hear people talking. And it helped me massively to do that.
And in terms of the help you're getting now, you mentioned you got somebody you speak to on a regular basis. Do you see that now as part of your life, or do you see a particular moment where you can, you know, shake hands with that person and walk away from that?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen her, about 14, 15 times now. The PFA have put that facility on. I know some people that obviously haven't got that facility where they're going to get it provided from, and I'm extremely grateful for that. But yeah, there'll be a day where, you know, I'm sure we'll keep in touch, because she knows everything about me now, and the family. She's helped Leona as well. Leona's been to some of the sessions with me, and we've done it together. So yeah, she'll always be a friend of the family now, and we'll always keep in touch. But yeah, it won't be so one-on-one or personal. I wouldn't have thought. Well, I'd like to think not.
Without obviously mentioning any names, since you've been speaking about it, and since your name is out there and your association obviously with the PFA, have other players come to you? Have you had tweets and messages and things like that?
I've had phone calls, text messages, current, past players. Say the response has been, I've not had one negative response off anyone, you know, even Leeds United fans or whatever. It's all been amazing. I thank everyone for that, because I think people nowadays know just what a serious, you know, a few years ago then it was, you know, get on with it and, you know, you grow up or whatever, man up. But now people realise what a serious problem it is, and said, I can't thank. The responses helped me a lot more as well, just some of the messages I've received. And I've spoke to people, you know, who are in a bad situation and tried to pass advice on to them. And as I said, I'm always, people can always get your phone number. So if anyone does need help, just try and get in contact.
I mean, and it's quite telling that, but in talking about it without necessarily setting out to become a poster boy for speaking out, you find yourself in that situation. We find it on this program as well, that people then contact the show because they're thinking, right, you seem to be talking about it. And I just wonder if everybody was talking about it, then we wouldn't have to have that thing of, oh, I need to speak to the former Liverpool goalkeeper to help me out. They'd be able to speak to somebody very much closer to them.
That's what it is. I mean, there's enough. Hopefully, there's enough, but there needs to be more things put in place. For you know, obviously we've got the Samaritan, and there's a lot of causes there. Friends and family, you know, just ask someone if they're okay. And you've got to talk. I didn't feel like talking for 5 years. It took me 5 years to start talking, but as soon as I did, it's a big, big weight off your shoulders. And just to be able to share it with other people, especially your family, and you know, if you're married or whatever, to be able to share it and to share that load that you're carrying is a big, big relief, and it was for me.
Chris, it's absolutely brilliant to get you on the programme. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story. Really appreciate it. We wish you all the best as well. We're a regular contributor to the station anyway. So next time we speak, it'll probably be a footy phone-in talking about who's Liverpool goalkeeper should be.
Anything you need.
But that's the 9 to 5. Thanks for giving us a little bit of a view outside that today. Chris Kirkland, our guest on Mental Health Monday. It's Radio City Talk.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Okay, so it's Mental Health Monday. You remember last week on the programme, we were talking with a couple of great guests who were sharing their brilliant stories, and it was really fantastic to get them on. Well, guess what? We got them back on again because there were things we couldn't say last week, which we can say this week. Jane Boland is with us, suicide prevention lead for Merseycare, and Angela Samata. We were talking last week about the fact they were working together with a new form of training, and as of officially 10 p.m. on the 15th of November 2017, we're allowed to talk about it, so that's exactly what we'll do now. Angela, thank you for coming back in. There was a strict embargo with this one, and there was also a big day in Parliament too.
That's right, absolutely. And it's out there. It's there. The culmination of our work is there. And we hope as many people as possible do the training. We're so proud of it.
Jane, we were talking last week about, you know, the importance of, you know, the training that you've had and your expertise and the clinical side of things, but this is about training for everybody and anybody. Anyone can find out. Why is there a need for that conversation?
There's a need for that conversation because 6,000 people died last year from suicide, and around two-thirds of those people had not had a conversation with anybody. They weren't in any sort of treatment or receiving any sort of help. And the need for the training is to give people the skills and confidence that you can have a conversation with somebody about suicide. It won't make them more likely to do it, and you can help them to identify where they can get some help.
I can almost hear people thinking now, in a few years' time, oh, if a situation they find themselves in means that they will think, ah, I wish I'd have done that training. I wish I knew a little bit more about this. So this is about a preemptive step that people will actively take as well. What sort of people do you think will want to take this?
Anybody who knows somebody.
That's a
literally anybody. What we want is like everybody. You know, hairdresser, taxi driver, barista, and anybody. We want anybody to do this training, because when we said to people, why wouldn't you ask somebody? If you saw somebody who was very distressed, why would you not ask them if they felt suicidal? And if they, you know, if they were going to do something. And the main reason that came back was because I wouldn't know what to do with the answer. So if they said yes, I'm feeling suicidal, I wouldn't know what to do with the answer. So the training, we were thinking about those people and thinking about, you know, how could we bring the best of Jane's clinical expertise to the general public, basically. So how could we not have any gatekeepers to this training, not have any guardians that say whether you can or you can't do it, not have anybody who was going to charge hundreds of pounds? How could we develop something that was going to mean that anybody could have this conversation and could feel more confident in having this conversation and then kind of knowing what to do with the answer? So it's just great that it's there, and we want a million people to do it. So I think that, it's something that we can kind of all equip ourselves, do the training, know how to have the conversation, know what to do with the answer. It's just brilliant. It's kind of like everything I've always dreamed of, really.
Jane, we're not talking about people having to go to university and do, you know, thousands of night classes on this one. Tell us about how the training actually works.
The training works. It takes 20 minutes. We've sort of distilled some really quite complex clinical knowledge and skills and information. I've done all the reading for you. I've sort of spoken to lots of people. I've done lots of training to think about what is the nub of what you need to understand. And, you know, as a person on the street, you need to understand that you can ask somebody directly. You can say, I'm concerned about you. Are you thinking of ending your life? Are you thinking of suicide? Somebody says that yes, I am, you can talk to them. And there are some really straightforward things that you could do to help them to access help. You know, you won't finish the training with a PhD in suicide, but you will, you know, and the way that the training is set up, it talks about, you know, think about, if you're going to have this conversation, some simple things you can do to be prepared. So we talk about some resources that you can access really easily that are out there already. So things like, you know, Papyrus, which is a sort of suicide prevention charity for young people, the Samaritans, the Hub of Hope, which is a sort of a Liverpool based app that you can find out where to access help for you. So you can go on. Do the training. You take them through a sort of a couple of simple scenarios about that show you how a conversation might happen. And then if you think it's going to happen, you can go back and have a look at the training again. It's that accessible. You know, you'll just have to, you'll go in through the Zero Suicide Alliance website and you'll be able to go on the training. And then if you need to redo it a week later, you can go back again. And the Alliance website will also have other links and information about, you know, how you might be able to find help in your local area and what the person can do.
Angela, is part of it the idea that people might not talk about it because, you know, God forbid you ask somebody if they're feeling suicidal and they say yes.
Exactly.
If you're not trained, you don't know. It puts you in a very difficult situation because suddenly you're thinking, well, now I'm sort of part of this story and I'm without a weapon, if you like, but this provides the weapon.
Absolutely. And I think it is about empowering people to, you know, we all know that waiting lists are kind of through the roof. We all know that, you know, sometimes it's seen that only clinicians can have the answers, only clinicians can help. Well, what we've done in this training is basically take clinical knowledge and clinical expertise, bring it to the general public so that it's the general public that can choose if they want to kind of just spend 20 minutes, I don't know, as long as it takes to have a cup of tea, as long as it takes to nip out and buy a sandwich, whatever it is. In that 20 minutes, you can actually kind of arm yourself, if you like, educate yourself, kind of, you know, to be the person who is confident in having that conversation, because you never know when that conversation is going to happen. Johnny Benjamin is one of the people that we filmed for the training. And Johnny talks about kind of that morning that he was standing on Waterloo Bridge and Neil was the stranger who came to him on the bridge and kind of stopped him from taking his life. Neither one of those people, Neil or Johnny, could have predicted that conversation was going to happen when Neil was on his way to work that morning. So again, it's about just spending 20 minutes doing the training, thinking about how you kind of make yourself more confident in having the conversation and knowing what to do with the answer. It's really see, say, signpost, see the opportunity to have the conversation, say the word, ask somebody if they're feeling suicidal and signpost to support. And we can all have our own little stack of cards or numbers or just kind of know the places that you can say to someone. If you go on the Hub of Hope, there's loads of places. Let's have a look at it now. Let's get my phone out and let's have a look at it now together and we can find you some help. So it's not about, as Jane said, it's not about kind of, you know, becoming a clinician in 20 minutes. It's about all of us taking the chance. You know, suicide is everybody's opportunity to help each other. So it's not just about it being everybody's problem. It's everybody's opportunity.
If you want to find out more information, zerosuicidealliance.com. That's www.zerosuicidealliance.com. Takes about 20 minutes and it could save a life. Angela, you know, incredible work that you've done this as well. You lost your husband to suicide and yet now you're working on something which might actually save other lives that stops people going through the experience that you had as well. I think that's wonderful that you're at this stage as well, that you've said, right, I'm going to do something about this. Mm. And you absolutely have. And I think you should just be unbelievably proud of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My boys, you know, I've got two boys. Yeah. They're 28 and 17. And so I think that I know that my children are in a high-risk group because they're men and they're under 50. So I think that that's the thing that kind of keeps me going with this, really. And it's wonderful to have had the launch in Parliament. I mean, what an amazing thing for Parliament to support our endeavour, really. So, yeah, it's let's see what happens. Get on the train. And you can do it on your phone, by the way. You can do it on your phone.
You'd be able to do it on your phone, on sort of a smartphone, on your laptop.
Yeah. Just need some earphones and you're away. So.
And it's going to be available for people who are deaf as well. It's part of our sort of project. We've done something quite innovative, and the resource will be available in BSL. So people who are deaf will be able to access it and access it in BSL.
Fantastic. Jane, do you think this is going to save lives?
Yes. I know it's going to save lives.
Thank you for your time. Great to see you once again. Jane Boland, Suicide Prevention Lead for Merseycare, and Angela Samata joined us at Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle. This is Radio City Talk.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to get Angela Samata in the studio, brilliant contributor to Radio City Talk, and Jane as well, who together have been working really hard to get this training up and running. It takes no time at all to do, but it's for everybody as well. I'd urge you to follow those links and try it out for yourself. You never know when you might need it. If you ever want to get involved in Mental Health Monday, you've got a story of your own. It doesn't have to be a story which is national. Maybe you've got a local organisation and you want to share what you're up to when it comes to mental health, then absolutely drop me an email and tell me about it. Now, somebody who's done just that is an organisation who are running a series of events taking place in Liverpool, including one event coming up on the 25th, and I was joined in the studio by a Buddhist monk by the name of Jigme, who joined me to talk about meditation, what it can do to you, and his own mental health as well. His name is Jigme. You can get involved in these events. All the details to come here on Radio City Talk.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
So it's Radio City Talk. It's Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. My next guest is going to be telling us about an event which is taking place on Saturday, the 25th of November. And it's titled Dealing with Depression. It's a half-day meditation and mindfulness course. And it's taking place at the Quaker Meeting House. Welcome to the programme, Kelsang Jigme. Thank you for coming in.
That's my name. Jigme's my name, yeah.
Just tell us about what you're wearing, if you don't mind me saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm wearing the robes of Buddhist monk, because that's what I've been a Buddhist monk since 1997, and in August I was asked to come to teach meditation in Liverpool. We've had a centre in Liverpool for many years, but I was asked to come and be the teacher here, and so far I'm loving it. I'm really enjoying the city. I find Liverpool people incredibly friendly, and we have a great centre there. It's on Sefton Park on Egbert Drive.
A lovely part of the city.
It really is, yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'm really finding that actually this city is quite a forward-thinking one when it comes to mindfulness, awareness of mental health as well. I guess the fact that you were invited to come up here and be part of it,
yeah,
is testimony to that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we had. I actually came here in July. The centre ran a course at St George's Hall on overcoming anxiety, and that course, I think we could have probably, if we'd done two courses, we could have filled them. It was really popular, so it just shows that people in Liverpool are quite forward thinking in terms of looking into things like meditation and mindfulness as solutions to some of the problems that we all experience nowadays.
I was going to say, you know, in that they're open-minded about the solutions, but also that maybe they feel that they have a problem as well.
Yeah,
I guess that's one of the issues that we're facing in society at the moment, that people are looking at their lives and they're just thinking, things aren't going as I anticipated them to be, or I've got certain feelings I wasn't quite expecting to have at this stage as well. But through the work that you're doing, you're helping some of those people find their own path.
Yes, I mean, actually, that's something that's very fundamental to the Buddhist approach to meditation, that we understand that you can be quite well off, you can have a good standard of living, you can have good friends, but that doesn't mean that you'll necessarily be happy. And I think many of us nowadays, you know, we've got all the shiny iPhones and everything, maybe, but we're finding that it doesn't make us happy. And so now I think people are looking beyond material things, because you know, to I know not everybody's got these things, but compared with many people on this planet, we don't do badly. We're pretty well off, you know, and but we still experience unpeaceful and unhappy states of mind. So it's showing us that there has to be more to life, and we need to look for solutions elsewhere, because it's not working for us. Just trying to be rich, trying to be good looking, trying to be all these things. You know, that's not working. It's not giving us the satisfaction and the peace that we hope for.
And I asked you about being a Buddhist monk, because I think it's really interesting that so many people we speak to, they look for modern solutions to, mm-hmm. to modern mm-hmm. problems, or they might engage in might be knitting, it mm-hmm. might be sport, mm-hmm. it might be running as well. Does the fact that you are coming from a Buddhist background, does that give you almost a historic way of dealing with mental health issues and depressions or anxieties that people might be going through?
Maybe you could say that. Although I think, to be honest with you, I think what we're finding is that these teachings and practices like meditation and mindfulness, they're actually very applicable to modern life, and they work perfectly for modern people. And you know, we always say everybody's welcome. Although these teachings come from the Buddhist tradition, everybody's welcome to come along and try them out. And I think that it really fits and works with our busy modern lifestyle. It's about learning how to find some peace within our own mind while we're dealing with all our busy lives. I mean, we can't all run off and live in a forest hut. You know, people have to go to work. They've got to look after the kids. They've got to live their modern lives. But these teachings on mindfulness and meditation, simple practices like meditation and mindfulness, really help people to keep a happy and peaceful mind in the midst of all that busy modern life.
Yeah, if people want to find out more information, meditationinliverpool.org.uk /events. That's meditationinliverpool.org.uk/events. There's a small course fee for that one, dealing with depression, a half-day meditation and mindfulness course, and it's taking place at the Quaker Meeting House. We've got Jigme in the studio talking about mental health on Mental Health Monday. Jigme, I wonder whether or not, you know, sometimes we talk about offering people almost coping strategies to deal with modern life. And I sometimes wonder whether or not when we offer coping strategies, what we're doing is we're giving people a resilience to cope with the things that they are feeling or the issues that they're facing in life. And I wonder whether or not that doesn't necessarily take away some of those problems that might be there in the first place. So do we just accept now in 2017 that life is tough and we just need to find ways of getting by? Or are there things we can do in life which actually means we're not forever trying to be resilient, that we're not constantly trying to create a force field around ourselves?
That's a very interesting point. I think we really have to understand something quite deep, actually. It's quite simple, but it's quite deep. And that is that when we have problems, when we're not happy, that's something that we are feeling in our mind. You know, it's our mind that's not happy. And happiness and suffering they're states of mind. They're not. You can't buy happiness in the shops. And actually, no one or nothing can make you suffer. It's about how our mind responds and reacts. So this was sort of Buddha's insight all those thousands of years ago. He understood that if we can learn how to keep a peaceful and a positive mind, then we might find ourselves in difficult situations, but they won't be a problem for us. They won't, because we're not responding to them negatively. And I think this is really important, because we tend to feel as if we've got no power to deal with difficulties. And so we do feel depressed often. We feel powerless to change how we feel, because we're always trying to change the external world around us. And you can't always do that. You know, you can't always. Sometimes you can fix things, but sometimes you can't. So what we do need to learn, I would say coping strategies, actually. But those coping strategies are actually, they're actually solving the problem for us. Because when our mind's peaceful and happy, we haven't got a problem.
Yeah, it's that thing, isn't it? How many times in your life do you say, "Oh, I give up"? Yeah. Maybe you don't say that as a Buddhist monk, I don't know. But, you know, oh, I give up. Like, you just think, this situation has got to a point where I can't deal with it.
Yeah.
I can see no way out of it, so I'm just going to give up and walk away. But what you're saying is actually, not only do you walk, you almost step back from it to then look at it from a different angle and then view the issue from a different way.
Absolutely right. It's like we mentally step back. So one sort of mantra, if you like, we can say, if something can be remedied, then why be unhappy about it? But if there's no remedy for it, well, then there's still no point in becoming unhappy. So we have to, if we can't change an external situation, we have to learn how to change our mind towards it, how to have a peaceful mind to the things you can't change. You know, if you can change it, great, then change it and fix it, but do it with a peaceful, happy mind. That's the answer, really, I think.
Can I ask you about your mental health, Jigme? Sort of the life that you lead now, the life that you had before you were ordained as well. Was mental health ever an issue? Do you think back to certain times now in your life where mental health might have been a problem for you?
Yeah. I ordained as a Buddhist monk when I was 25, and I'm 45 now, so that was 20 years ago. But in my early 20s, certainly I experienced some depression, and but I can say now that I no longer have that problem, and I do put that down largely, if not completely, to these practices of meditation and mindfulness. I found them incredibly helpful. So now, you know, I live a happy life, and I'm very very grateful to have met with these kinds of meditation practices that really work. They really help.
How do you view the unhappy 20 to 25 year old, the depressed 20 to 25 year old? Does that still feel like that was you? Because there'll be many people listening to this, Jigme, who'll be thinking, maybe I'm already in that state and I want to be where you're at. I want to be 20 years down the line, looking back at that and thinking, that's not a problem for me anymore.
Sure. I mean, honestly, I think that I wish that I'd been introduced to simple meditation practices much earlier on. I wish I'd been taught them at school, frankly, because I think that would have saved me a lot of heartache at those times. So I think that simple meditation and mindfulness practices are effective for everybody, and I'd encourage anyone who's feeling a bit, you know, at the end of their tether, they're feeling a bit hopeless. You know, they've tried many different things and it hasn't worked for them. Well, give meditation a try. You know, come and try to find a little bit of peace in your mind, and that will help. It will definitely help. And these practices are simple; anyone can do them.
Well, I was going to say, because the thing that will put people off will not be your invite or the idea of the things that you've talked about. It'll be, well, I've never done it before. I don't know what to wear. I don't know whether or not I'm going to go show up and there's going to be chimes and smoke and I'm going to be, you know, people are going to try and get me to sign up to Buddhism and things like that. It'll be those little things as well. So what environment will people see when they come down?
Okay, well, I mean, the event on Saturday the 25th, the Dealing with Depression half-day course, that's at the Quaker Meeting House, which is a lovely modern venue. It's right next door to the Blue Coats on School Lane down in Liverpool One. We sit on chairs. You don't need any special clothes, and you'll see a whole range of people there. There'll be, you know, people of all ages and from all different walks of life. We don't. We tend to have, you know, normal lighting, normal everything, really. We don't really go for, chimes and incense and sandals. And we tend to be a bit more modern.
If you want to wear sandals, I'm sure you're allowed to wear sandals.
I wear sandals from time to time. You're very welcome.
Come comfortable.
You can wear. Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's probably the best advice, is just dress comfortably. But there's no, you know, you're not going to have to get into any funny positions or postures, sitting on chairs. And I mean, one thing I think people are pleasantly surprised by just how normal it is, and how normal everybody who attends these things they are.
Brilliant. If people want to find out some more information about that, I mentioned the website and I'll mention it again, meditationinliverpool.org.uk. If you're on there, you might also see there's a morning meditation that you do. This is on a Wednesday in Sefton Park as well, at the Sefton Park Palm House.
That's right.
I think just walking through the doors at a palm house can help people relax, because what a fabulous space there. But that's a weekly thing you do.
That's a weekly thing on Wednesday mornings at, I think it's, is it 11 o'clock?
10.45.
10.45, thank you very much. yeah, we just started that one actually, but that seems to be quite popular.
What a great venue as well.
It's a lovely place, yeah, and people can come and just wander in from the park and sit and enjoy some meditation. And we do meditation classes at the centre, which is on Egbert Drive, overlooking the park. And we also do, we run classes at several different venues around the city. But you can see all those on the website.
Absolutely. And I will point people in the direction of the website again, meditationinliverpool.org.uk. You can find out about the details of the event taking place on the 25th of November, Dealing with Depression. That's at the Quaker Meeting House, as we heard, School Lane in town. And then the Wednesday sessions as well in Sefton Park. A small fee for each of those, but if it was really expensive, I'd warn you. But yeah. it's affordable as well.
We don't make any, we're a charity, we don't make any sort of personal profit from those, but it's to meet our running costs and venue hires and things like that.
Jignay, it's been fascinating to get you on the programme. Really appreciate you coming in. And I look forward to speaking to you again, because I think it's, particularly with the Buddhism element, it's an element we've not touched on the programme before. But I think by talking about sort of where people are coming from and how they're viewing the world, I think it gives people a greater perspective on the opportunities that are out there for them. So I really appreciate you joining us on Mental Health Monday, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Mental Health Monday, proving once again that there are loads of different things going on around the Northwest region when it comes to mental health and how you might want to engage with it yourself and maybe sign up to one of those meditation classes or go and find something similar within your own community. Just a quick word, by the way. Thank you to everybody who's been nice on social media about me and producer Lizzie going down to the Mind Media Awards. We had a right old great time of it. The Odeon Leicester Square. I was up in the Journalist of the Year category, and again, some really, really top competition. And some of the people who were down there were the very best of the very best when it comes to broadcasters, broadcast organisations as well. So it was nice to represent Radio City, Radio City Talk down there as well. Didn't win in our category. Well done to Catherine Jones from Channel 5 News, who won in the journalist category. But it was such a great night. We had a really great time, a really warm sort of community down there as well, and it was quite a show busy bash as well, so we enjoyed it too. But maybe next year we'll see how we crack on, but we'll continue with Mental Health Monday well into 2018. Don't you worry about that. Thanks for downloading the podcast, and also thanks for listening right to the end. Another podcast will be available in the coming weeks. We've got loads of great guests lined up, including stand-up comedians and Pussycat Dolls, so you don't have to go anywhere. It's Mental Health Monday from Radio City Talk. My name's Mick. I'll catch you again soon.
Radio City Talks Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.